The storm clouds sped towards the hill. They piled up in a towering mass very fast. Lightning flashed somewhere in the core.
"There's too much life around," said Death. "Not that I'm one to complain. Where's the child?"
"I put her to bed. She's sleeping now, just ordinary sleep."
Lightning struck on the hill like a thunderbolt. It was followed by a clanking, grinding noise somewhere in the middle distance. Death sighed.
"Ah, more drama."
He walked around the barn so that he could command a good view of the dark fields. Miss Flitworth followed very closely on his heels, using him as a shield against whatever terrors were out there. A blue glow crackled behind a distant hedge. It was moving.
"What is it?"
"It was the combination harvester."
"Was? What is it now?"
Death glanced at the clustering watchers.
"A poor loser."
The harvester tore across the soaking fields, cloth arms whirring, levers moving inside an electric blue nimbus. The shafts for the horse waved uselessly in the air.
"How can it go without a horse? It had a horse yesterday."
"It doesn't need one."
He looked around at the grey watchers. There were ranks of them now.
"Binky's still in the yard. Come on."
"No."
The combination harvester accelerated towards them. The ship, ship of its blades became a whine.
"Is it angry because you stole its tarpaulin?"
"That's not all I stole."
Death grinned at the watchers. He picked up his scythe, turned it over in his hands, and then, when he was sure their gaze was fixed upon it, let it fall to the ground. Then he folded his arms. Miss Flitworth dragged at him.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Drama."
The harvester reached the gate into the yard and came through in a cloud of sawdust.
"Are you sure we'll be all right?"
Death nodded.
Well, that's all right, then."
The harvester's wheels were a blur.
"Probably."
And then something in the machinery went clonk. Then the harvester was still travelling, but in pieces. Sparks fountained up from its axles. A few spindles and arms managed to hold together, jerking madly as they spun away from the whirling, slowing confusion. The circle of blades tore free, smashed up through the machine, and skimmed away across the fields. There was a jangle, a clatter, and then the last isolated boing, which is the audible equivalent of the famous pair of smoking boots. And then there was silence. Death reached down calmly and picked up a complicated-looking spindle as it pinwheeled towards his feet. It had been bent into a right angle. Miss Flitworth peered around him.
"What happened?"
"I think the elliptical cam has gradually slid up the beam shaft and caught on the flange rebate, with disastrous results."
Death stared defiantly at the grey watchers. One by one they began to disappear. He picked up the scythe.
"And now I must go," he said.
Miss Flitworth looked horrified.
"What, just like that?"
"Yes, exactly like that. I have a lot of work to do."
"And I won't see you again. I mean..."
"Oh, yes. Soon."
He sought for the right words and gave up.
"That's a promise."
Death pulled up his robe and reached into the pocket of his Bildor overall, which he was still wearing underneath.
"When Mr. Simnel comes to collect the bits in the morning, he will probably be looking for this," he said,
and dropped something small and beveled into her hands.
"What is it?"
"A 3/8 Gripply."
Death walked over to his horse, and then remembered something.
"And he owes me a farthing, too."
Ridcully opened one eye. People were milling around. There were lights and excitement. Lots of people were talking at once. He seemed to be sitting in a very uncomfortable pram, with some strange insects buzzing around him. He could hear the dean complaining, and there were groans that could only be coming from the bursar, and the voice of a young woman. People were being ministered to, but no one was paying him any attention. Well, if there was any ministering going on, he was damn well going to get ministered to as well. He coughed loudly.
"You could try," he said to the cruel world in general, "forcing some brandy between my lips."
An apparition appeared above him, holding a lamp over its head. It was a size 5 face in a size 13 skin. It said,
"Ooh?"
in a concerned way.
Oh, it's you," said Ridcully.
He tried to sit up quickly, just in case the librarian tried the kiss of life. Confused memories wobbled across his brain. He could remember a wall of clanking metal, and then pinkness, and then music. endless music designed to turn the living brain to cream cheese. He turned around. There was a building behind him, surrounded by crowds of people. It was squat and clung to the ground in a strangely animal way, as if it might be possible to lift up a wing of the building and hear the pop-pop-pop of suckers letting go. Light streamed out of it, and steam curled out of its doors.
Ridcully's woken up!
More faces appeared. Ridcully thought, it's not Soul Cake night, so they're not wearing masks. Ugh, blast. Behind them he heard the Dean say, I vote we work up her petty seismic reorganizer and lob it through the door. No more problem.
No, we're too close to the city walls. We just need to drop Quandam's attractive point in the right place.
Or some jumpers incendiary surprise, perhaps.
This was the bursar's voice.
Burn it out. It's the best way.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you know about military tactics? You can't even say yo properly.
Ridcully gripped the sides of the trolley.
Would anyone mind telling me, he said, what the heck is going on?
Ludmilla pushed her way through the members of the Fresh Start Club.
You've got to stop them, Arch-Chancellor, she said. They're talking about destroying the big shop.
More nasty recollections settled on Ridcully's mind.
Good idea, he said.
But Mr. Poons is still in there.
Ridcully tried to focus on the glowing building.
What? Dead Windlepoons?
Arthur flew back when we realised he wasn't with us, and he said Windle was fighting something that had come out of the walls. We saw lots of trolleys, but they weren't bothered about us. He let us get out.
What? Dead Windlepoons? You can't magic the place to bits with one of your wizards in there. What? Dead Windlepoons?
Yes.
But he's dead, said Ridcully. Isn't he? He said he was.
Ha, said someone who had much less skin than Ridcully would have liked him to have.
That's typical. That's naked vitalism, that is. I bet they'd rescue someone in there if they happened to be alive.
But he wasn't too keen on,
Ridcully hazarded. A lot of this was beyond him, but to people like Ridcully this didn't matter for very long. Ridcully was simple-minded. This doesn't mean stupid, it just meant that he could only think properly about things if he cut away all the complicated bits around the edges. He concentrated on the single main fact. Someone who was technically a wizard was in trouble. He could relate to that. It struck a chord. The whole dead or alive business could wait. There was another minor point that nagged at him, though.
Arthur? Flew?
Hello? Ridcully turned his head. He blinked slowly.
Nice teeth you've got there, he said.
Thank you, said Arthur Winkings.
All your own, are they?
Oh, yes.
Amazing. Of course, I expect you brush regularly.
Yes.
Hygienic, that's the important thing.
So what are you gonna do? Said Ludmilla.
Well, we'll just go fetch him out,
said Ridcully. What was it about the girl? He felt a strange urge to pat her on the head.
We'll get some magic and get him out. Yes, Dean.
Yo, we're just going to go in there to get Windle out. Yo.
What? Said the senior wrangler. You must be out of your mind.
Ridcully tried to look as dignified as possible, given his situation.
Remember that I am your Arch-Chancellor, he snapped.
"Then you must be out of your mind, Arch-Chancellor,"
said the senior wrangler. He lowered his voice.
"Anyway, he's an undead. I don't see how you can save undeads. It's a sort of contradiction in terms."
"A dichotomy," said the bursar helpfully.
"Oh, I don't think surgery is involved."
"Anyway, didn't we bury him?"
said the lecturer in recent runes.
"And now we dig him up again,"
said the Arch-Chancellor.
It's probably a miracle of existence.
Like pickles,
said the bursar happily. Even the fresh starters went blank.
They do that in parts of her wonderland, said the bursar. They make these big, big jars of special pickles, and then they bury them in the ground for months to ferment, and then they get this lovely, piquant...
Tell me, Ludmilla whispered to Ridcully, is this how wizards usually behave? "The senior wrangler is an amazingly fine example," said Ridcully. "Got the same urgent grasp of reality as a cardboard cutout. Proud to have him on the team." He rubbed his hands together. "Okay, lads. Volunteers?" "Yo, hut," said the Dean, who was in an entirely different world now.
"I would be remiss in my duty if I failed to help a brother," said Red Shoe.
"Ook." "You? We can't take you," said the Dean, glaring at the librarian. "You don't know a thing about guerrilla warfare."
"Ook,"
said the librarian, and made a surprisingly comprehensive gesture to indicate that, on the other hand, what he didn't know about orangutan warfare could be written on the very small, pounded-up remains of, for example, the Dean.
"Four of us should be enough," said the Arch-Chancellor.
"I've never even heard him say yo," muttered the Dean.
He removed his hat, something a wizard doesn't ordinarily do unless he's about to pull something out of it, and handed it to the bursar. Then he tore a thin strip off the bottom of his robe and held it dramatically in both hands and tied it around his forehead.
"It's part of the ethos," he said, in answer to their penetratingly unspoken question. "That's what the warriors on the counterweight continent do before they go into battle. And you have to shout."
He tried to remember some far-off reading. Bonsai. Yes, bonsai.
"I thought that meant chopping bits off trees to make them small," said the senior wrangler.
The Dean hesitated. He wasn't too sure himself if it came to it, but a good wizard never let uncertainty stand in the way.
"No, it's definitely got to be bonsai," he said.
He considered it some more and then brightened up. "On account of it all being part of Bushido, like small trees, Bushido. Yeah, makes sense when you think about it."
"But you can't shout bonsai here," said the lecturer in recent runes. "We've got a totally different cultural background. It'd be useless. No one will know what you mean."
"I'll work on it," said the Dean.
He noticed Ludmilla standing with her mouth open.
"This is wizard talk," he said.
"It is, isn't it?" said Ludmilla. "I never would have guessed."
The Arch-Chancellor had got out of the trolley and was wheeling it experimentally back and forth. It usually took quite a long time for a fresh idea to fully lodge in Ridcully's mind, but he felt instinctively that there were all sorts of uses for a wire basket on four wheels.
"Are we going, or are we standing around all night bandaging our heads?" he said.
"Yo!" snapped the Dean.
"Yo?"
said Red Shoe.
"Ook!"
"Was that a yo?"
said the Dean suspiciously.
"Ook!"
"Well, all right then."
Death sat on a mountaintop. It wasn't particularly high, or bare, or sinister. No witches held naked sabbats on it. Discworld witches, on the whole, didn't hold with taking off any more clothes than was absolutely necessary for the business in hand. No spectres haunted it. No naked little men sat on the summit dispensing wisdom, because the first thing the truly wise man works out is that sitting around on a mountain top gives you not only hemorrhoids, but frostbitten hemorrhoids. Occasionally people would climb the mountain and add a stone or two to the cairn at the top, if only to prove that there is nothing really damn stupid that humans won't do. Death sat on the cairn and ran a stone down the blade of his scythe in long, deliberate strokes. There was a movement of air. Three grey servants popped into existence. One said, "You think you have won." One said, "You think you have triumphed." Death turned the stone in his hand to get a fresh surface and brought it slowly down the length of the blade. One said, "We will inform Azrael." One said, "You are only, after all, a little death." Death held the blade up to the moonlight, twisting it this way and that, noting the play of light on the tiny flecks of metal on its edge. Then he stood up in one quick movement. The servants backed away hurriedly. He reached out with the speed of a snake and grasped a robe, pulling its empty hood level with his eye sockets.
"Do you know why the prisoner in the tower watches the flight of birds?" he said.
It said, "Take your hands off me. Oops." Blue flame flared for a moment. Death lowered his hand and looked around at the other two. One said, "You haven't heard the last of this." They vanished. Death brushed a speck of ash off his robe and then planted his feet squarely on the mountaintop. He raised the scythe over his head in both hands and summoned all the lesser deaths that had arisen in his absence. After a while, they streamed up the mountain in a faint black wave. They flowed together like dark mercury. It went on for a long time and then stopped. Death lowered the scythe and examined himself. Yes, all there. Once again, he was the death, containing all the deaths of the world. Except for... For a moment, he hesitated. There was one tiny area of emptiness somewhere, some fragment of his soul, something unaccounted for. He couldn't be quite certain what it was. He shrugged. Doubtless he'd find out. In the meantime, there was a lot of work to be done. He rode away. Far off, in his den under the barn, the death of rats relaxed his determined grip on a beam. Windlepoons brought both feet down heavily on a tentacle snaking out from under the tiles and lurched off through the steam. A slab of marble smashed down, showering him with fragments, then he kicked the wall savagely. There was very probably no way out now, he realized, and even if there was, he couldn't find it. Anyway, he was already inside the thing. It was shaking its own walls down in an effort to get at him. At least he could give it a really bad case of indigestion. He headed towards an orifice that had once been the entrance to a wide passage and dived awkwardly through it just before it snapped shut. Silver fire crackled over the walls. There was so much life here it couldn't be contained. There were a few trolleys still here, skittering madly across the shaking floor, as lost as Windle. He set off along another likely-looking corridor, although most corridors he'd been down in the last 130 years hadn't pulsated and dripped so much. Another tentacle thrust through the wall and tripped him up. Of course, it couldn't kill him, but it could make him bodiless. Like old one-man Bucket. A fate worse than death, probably. He pulled himself up. The ceiling bounced down on him, flattening him against the floor. He counted under his breath and scampered forward. Steam washed over him. He slipped again and thrust out his hands. He could feel himself losing control. There were too many things to operate, never mind the spleen. Just keeping the heart and lungs going was taking too much effort.
Topiary! What the heck do you mean? Topiary, get it? Yo!
Wook!
Windle looked up through foggy eyes. Ah, obviously he was losing control of his brain, too. A trolley came sideways out of the steam with shadowy figures clinging onto its sides. One hairy arm, and one arm that was barely an arm anymore, reached down, picked him up bodily, and dumped him into the basket. Four tiny wheels skidded on the floor, the trolley bounced off the wall, and then it righted itself and rattled away. Windle was only vaguely aware of voices.
"Off you go, Dean. I know you've been looking forward to it."
That was the Arch-Chancellor.
"Yo!"
"You'll kill it, totally. I don't think we want it ending up at the Fresh Start Club. I don't think it's a joiner."
That was Red Shoe.
"Ooh!"
That was the Librarian.
"Don't you worry, Windle. The Dean is going to do something... military, apparently,"
said Ridcully.
"Yo! Hut! Oh, good grief!"
Windle saw the Dean's hand float past with something glittering in it.
"What are you going to use?" said Ridcully, as the trolley rocketed through the steam. "The seismic reorganizer, the attractive point, or the incendiary surprise?"
"Yo!"
said the Dean with satisfaction.
"What, all three at once? Yo!"
"That's going a bit far, isn't it?
And, incidentally, if you say yo one more time, Dean, I will personally have you thrown out of the university, pursued to the rim of the world by the finest demons that thaumaturgy can conjure up, torn into extremely small pieces, minced, turned into a mixture reminiscent of steak tartare, and turned out into a dog bowl."
The Dean caught Ridcully's eye.
Yes. "Oh, go on, Arch-Chancellor. What's the good of having mastery over cosmic balance and knowing the secrets of fate if you can't blow something up? Please. I've got them all ready. You know how it upsets the inventory if you don't use them after you've got them ready."
The trolley whirred up a trembling slope and cornered on two wheels.
"Oh, all right," said Ridcully. "If it means that much to you."
Sorry. The Dean started to mutter urgently under his breath and then screamed.
"I've gone blind!"
"Your bonsai bandage has slipped over your eyes, Dean." Windle groaned.
How are you feeling, Brother Poons?
Red Shoe's ravaged features occluded Windle's view.
Oh, you know, said Windle, could be better, could be worse.
The trolley ricocheted off a wall and jerked away in another direction. How are those spells coming along, Dean? Said Ridcully through gritted teeth. I'm having real difficulties controlling this thing. The Dean muttered a few more words and then waved his hands dramatically. Octarine flame spurted from his fingertips and earthed itself somewhere in the mists.
Yee-haw! He crowed.
Dean?
Yes, Arch-Chancellor?
The comment I made recently about the Y word...
Yes, yes.
You can definitely include yee-haw, too. The Dean hung his head.
Oh, yes, Arch-Chancellor.
And why hasn't everything gone boom?
I put a slight delay on it, Arch-Chancellor. I thought perhaps we ought to get out before things happened.
Good thinking, that man.
Soon have you out, Windle, said Red Shoe. We don't leave our people in there. Isn't this...
And then the floor erupted ahead of them. And then behind them. The thing that arose from the shattered tiles was either formless or many forms at once. It writhed angrily, snapping its tubing at them. The trolley skewed to a halt.
Got any more magic, Dean?
No, Arch-Chancellor.
And the spells you just said will go off...
Any second now, Arch-Chancellor.
So, whatever's going to happen is going to happen to us.
Yes, Arch-Chancellor.
Ridcully patted Windle on the head. Sorry about this, he said. Windle turned awkwardly to look down the passageway. There was something behind the Queen. It looked like a perfectly ordinary bedroom door, advancing in a series of small steps, as though someone was carefully pushing it along in front of them.
What is it? Said Reg.
Windle raised himself as far as he could.
Schleppel!
Oh, come on, said Reg.
It's Schleppel! Shouted Windle. Schleppel! It's us! Can you help us out?
The door paused, then it was flung aside. Schleppel unfolded himself to his full height.
"Hello, Mr. Poons. Hello, Reg," he said.
They stared at the hairy shape that nearly filled the passageway.
"Schleppel, could you clear the way for us?"
Windle quavered.
"No problem, Mr. Poons. Anything for a friend."
A hand the size of a wheelbarrow glided through the steam and tore into the blockage, ripping it out with incredible ease.
"Hey, look at me," said Schleppel. "You're right. A bogeyman needs a door like a fish needs a bicycle. Say it now, and say it loud. I'm..."
"And now, could you get out of the way, please?"
"Sure, sure. Wow."
Schleppel took another swipe at the Queen. The trolley shot forward.
"And you'd better come with us,"
Windle shouted as Schleppel disappeared in the mists.
"No, he shouldn't," said the Arch-Chancellor as they sped along. "Believe me, what was it?"
"He's a bogeyman," said Windle.
"I thought you only get them in closets and things," shouted Ridcully.
"He's come out of the closet," said Red Shoe proudly, "and he's found himself."
"Just so long as we can lose him."
"We can't just leave him."
We can, snapped Ridcully.
There was a sound behind them like an eruption of swamp gas. Green light streamed past.
"The spells are starting to go off," shouted the Dean. "Move it."
The trolley whirred out of the entrance and soared up into the cool of the night, wheels screaming.
"Yo!"
bellowed Ridcully, as the crowd scattered ahead of them.
"Does that mean I can say yo, too?" said the Dean. "All right, just once. Everyone can say it just once." "Yo!"
"Yo!"
echoed Red Shoe.
"Ook!"
"Yo!"
said Windle Poons.
"Yo!"
said Schleppel. Somewhere in the darkness, where the crowd was thinnest, the gaunt shape of Mr. Ixalite, the world's last surviving banshee, sidled up to the shaking building and bashfully shoved a note under the door. It said, "Oo-ee-oo-ee-oo-ee-oo." The trolley ploughed to a very definitive stop.
No one turned around. Reg said slowly,
"You're behind us, right?"
"That's right, Mr. Shoe," said Schleppel happily.
"Should we worry when he's in front of us?" said Ridcully. "Or is it worse because we know he's behind us?"
"Ha ha! No more closets and cellars for this bogey," said Schleppel.
"That's a shame, because we've got some really big cellars at the university," said Windle Poons quickly.
Schleppel was silent for a while. Then he said, in an exploratory tone of voice,
"How big?"
"Huge."
"Yeah? With rats?"
"Rats aren't the half of it. There's escaped demons and all sorts down there. Infested they are."
"What are you doing?" hissed Ridcully. "That's our cellars you're talking about."
"You'd prefer him under your bed, would you?" murmured Windle. "Or walking around behind you?"
Ridcully nodded briskly. "Wow, yes, those rats are getting really out of hand down there," he said loudly. "Some of them, oh, about 2 feet long, wouldn't you say, Dean?"
3 feet, said the Dean, at least.
"Fat as butter, too," said Windle.
Schleppel gave this some thought.
"Well, all right," he said, reluctantly. "Maybe I'll just wander in and have a look at them."
The big store exploded and imploded at the same time, something it is almost impossible to achieve without a huge special effects budget or 3 spells all working against one another. There was the impression of a vast cloud expanding, but at the same time moving away so rapidly that the overall effect was of a shrinking point. Walls buckled and were sucked in. Soil ripped up from the ravaged fields and spiralled into the vortex. There was a violent burst of non-music, which died almost instantly. And then nothing, except a muddy field. And, floating down from the early morning sky like snow, thousands of white flakes, they slid silently through the air and landed lightly on the crowd.
"It's not seeding, is it?" said Red Shoe.
Windle grabbed one of the flakes. It was a crude rectangle, uneven and blotchy. It was just about possible, with a certain amount of imagination, to make out the words, "Closenig down slay, everythnig must og."
"No," said Windle, "probably not."
He lay back and smiled. It was never too late to have a good life. And when no one was looking, the last surviving trolley on the Discworld rattled off sadly into the oblivion of the night, lost and alone. It is generally thought, on those worlds where the mal-life form has seeded, that people take the wire baskets away and leave them in strange and isolated places, so that squads of young men have to be employed to gather them together and wheel them back. This is the exact opposite of the truth. In reality, the men are hunters, stalking their rattling prey across the landscape, trapping them, breaking their spirit, taming them, and herding them to a life of slavery. Possibly.